The first, that Holmstrom versus MetLife. Apparently we're covered there.
Morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Mark Dabowski. I represent the plaintiff appellant, Lynette Holmstrom. Upon the district court's finding that this was a close case, and the finding with respect to the second appeal that this was even a closer case, which the court made on page 35 of the slip opinion, the view of MetLife's inherent conflict of interest in history of biased claims administration, the district court's failure to assess the factors highlighted in MetLife versus Glenn in this circuit's precedence necessitates reversal of the court below. In the Majeski versus MetLife case issued late last year, this court indicated that procedural reasonableness is the cornerstone of the arbitrary and capricious inquiry. We contend that in addition to the conflict of interest, there are at least six identifiable factors from the record of this case that demonstrate procedural unreasonableness that should lead this court to conclude that the decision made by MetLife was arbitrary and capricious.
So Mr. Dabowski, before you get too far into that, I'm interested in how either this court or any court should approach the question of a company's history of treatment of claims. Because I have to say, for a company as big as MetLife, the fact that there are some appellate decisions, even one from the Supreme Court, that happen to rule against it, doesn't tell me very much. I don't know how many claims they're assessing, how they're coming out in them, and I really feel that this isn't enough of an information base on which to draw an assumption that across the board they're biased.
I wish I could give the court a good answer to that question. The Supreme Court raised that factor in the Glenn case without giving the lower courts any guidance as far as how to assess the history of biased claims administration.
But it did that, though, in the context of the Unum long-term systematic company-wide policies, right?
Presumably, but the court in Glenn was obviously adjudicating a case involving MetLife. And in the Sixth Circuit opinion in the Glenn case, the court remarked that this was not the first time that the court had been called upon to assess MetLife's arbitrary and capricious conduct.
Should we look for a batting average in courts?
Yeah, that's impossible. I don't think that the Supreme Court intended that the history of biased claims administration was the be-all and end-all for the court's analysis. I think what the Supreme Court was saying in Glenn was that it's just something for the court to keep in the back of its mind in assessing the conflict, but the court has to be cognizant in every case where the structural conflict exists that the conflict is one of many factors that the court is to take into consideration. And the first and probably the most important factor relating to procedural unreasonableness was the prior history of this case. This case arose in the year 2000 when Ms. Holmstrom underwent two surgeries. MetLife reached a conclusion in 2000 that her impairments were permanent.
But here's my concern about that argument, Mr. Dabowski. Here, as you say, we have a woman who first qualifies under the 24-month your own job part of this plan, very common structure for a plan. And then she goes for about 3 years under the any job part of the plan. And then MetLife, for whatever reason, decides it's going to conduct a review to see if she still is qualified under that part or whatever, still meets the criteria of that part. And I'm concerned that if we were to hold it against companies that they had made an earlier decision to go ahead and give benefits, we would be creating a deterrent for that earlier decision. If they feel that they can go back and revisit it, they might be more willing to say, well, it looks to us right now, you know, you've just had these three surgeries, you've just had other things. We aren't making a commitment once and for all. See what I'm saying? I mean, I think that the incentive is tricky here.
I think this court's decision in the Ledger versus Tribune case, which also involved MetLife, offers guidance to this court. The Ledger case held that it was a factor to be considered, and the court said that you look at what took place between the initial decision and the decision to terminate benefits. And in this case, we had a finding in 2003, after the finding in 2002, that Ms. Holmstrom met the any occupation standard, that she remained totally disabled. In 2004, there was yet another finding that the claim should be reassessed only annually. The condition at issue was not one which was expected to improve, and I think that that's an important factor. But I think that the most important consideration here is when you look at what took place between when the initial decision was made and when the decision to terminate benefits was made, the key document in the record is found at page 173 of the claim record. It was the EMG report that was done, where the doctor, Gary Klein, had written that Ms. Holmstrom has been tried on, she's had three surgeries, she's been tried on physiotherapy with no benefit, five different attempts at nerve blocks, different medications, and he says, to make a long story short, her pain and dysesthesia continue, and if anything, are slowly getting worse. This took place within 2 months of the termination decision.
But, you know, I guess looking at the district court's opinion, it looks to me as though the district court is trying very hard, on the one hand, to credit her accounts of pain. The district court's clearly read our decisions. Just because you can't pin it down to an exact physical source doesn't matter. But then he's also asking the question, what functional limitations flow from that pain? And there, don't we have a record where some people think that there are functional limitations and other people think that there are not?
Well, based on this record, every doctor, every examiner, every therapist who has seen Ms. Holmstrom concluded that she had significant impairments. There were three doctors that MetLife hired who said that not all they did was review the records and came to a different conclusion.
Isn't it true that both the FCEs that were done in 2005 and 2007, the functional evaluations, found that she was disabled?
Completely, as well as the one in 2000 that was done, which is found at page 238 of the record. And if the court looks at all three of these FCEs, there's some minor differences between them. But it's a consistent finding. And that leads to yet another factor that we consider demonstrates procedural unreasonableness in this case. And that is that MetLife created a moving target. Every time MetLife demanded something, Ms. Holmstrom provided it. They said when they denied the claim and denied the appeal in 2005, gee, if we only had an FCE and psychological testing, then we could better assess you. So she provided yet a third FCE at her own expense. She provided psychological testing. It was never good enough. And I think much of this case comes down to the fact that when everything was done, and I think this is why the court said it was an even closer case on the final review, when it comes down to that, Dr. Manolakis, at page 532 of the record, writes a couple of very interesting things. First of all, he indicates that upon reconsideration of his opinion, it's more likely than not that the right upper extremity would be limited currently to occasional handling and grasping and fingering in an eight-hour workday. Now, this court's Social Security case law, the Smith versus Schweiker case, would indicate this person can't perform sedentary work. But even more importantly, Dr. Manolakis found in his fifth point that the point that I had raised in the claim appeal, that there was a need for a physical examination and not just a pure paper review in this case, was a point that was well taken. And he adds, quote, especially in a case such as this. Now, the Glenn case told the lower courts that ERISA imposes fiduciary obligations on plan administrators to get it right, to render accurate claim decisions. The Supreme Court added that the plan administrators were subject to higher than marketplace quality standards. When they get a report like this from their own consultant, what does MetLife do? They close the door. They deny the claim. They ignore what Dr. Manolakis told them. This is yet another example of procedural unreasonableness. Yet another example is the Social Security Award. MetLife encouraged Ms. Holmstrom to pursue Social Security and then took the apparent inconsistent position that the Social Security Award was irrelevant as far as their claim determination, but it was certainly relevant enough for them to pursue a $70,000 counterclaim.
So let me ask you this question about this Social Security decision in the light of this plan, because this is something I think perhaps we need to pay more attention to. For this particular plan, what are the differences, if any, between the standard that she would have to meet for the, what I'll call the long term, the any job part of the plan, and the Social Security Act standards?
As the LAD versus ITT case pointed out, which also involved MetLife, the differences are really immaterial from a functional standpoint. Both standards require that the claimant be incapable of performing any job. If anything, the MetLife standard is more lenient than the Social Security standard because it takes into consideration age, education, and work experience. So the fact that Ms. Holmstrom was awarded Social Security, and again, we go back to the Glenn case and the comment that the Supreme Court made that both positions taken by the insurer were financially advantageous to it, which demonstrates the conflict. Before I reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal, I would like to just say another word about the overpayment issue in this case. We do maintain that the Philpott versus Essex case from the Supreme Court is really dispositive on this issue. This court spoke in the Northcutt versus GM case that MetLife would be free to suspend, withhold benefits in the future, assuming that Ms. Holmstrom qualifies. But what they can't do under ERISA is sue to get money back.
So that your argument essentially is that this is not like Gouda because that was just a different insurance policy. There's no 407 standard protecting those benefits.
Exactly. 407 is what makes the difference in this case.
If you're right on the merits, and if we reverse an order payment, would there be any objection to a set-off based on the counterclaim?
I think that there would have to be based on this court's Northcutt case.
There would have to be an objection, or
there would have to be a set-off. The Social Security would have to be credited in that instance.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Von Schickler.
Good morning. My name is Warren Von Schleicher, and I represent MetLife and the Experian Employee Welfare Benefit Plan.
So let me begin with you, Mr. Schleicher, on this point that I think has been under-examined. The Supreme Court has certainly said, and lower courts, including ours, have said, that there is no necessary correlation between an award of Social Security benefits and an award under a plan, because just to take a clear example, sometimes people are of advanced age for Social Security purposes. They're older than 55, and so they get benefits, and the plans aren't written that way. But that doesn't mean that there isn't any overlap, and the language of some plans is functionally identical to the language that governs benefits for the Social Security Act. I can't see any serious difference, except perhaps in the direction that Mr. Dabowski suggests, between the any job aspect of this particular plan, the Experian MetLife plan, and the Social Security Act. Can you tell me what material differences there are?
I agree with Mr. Dabowski with respect to the functional test, because functionally, both tests look to whether someone is so functionally impaired that they're incapable of performing any job in the national economy.
So in other words, if she has qualified for Social Security benefits, she has also qualified for MetLife's any job.
Well, I said the functional test. There are also rules and presumptions that work in Social Security. And the record is different.
One is the
treating physician rule.
Which this court has practically read out of the statute. You know, we've said the treating physician applies unless the treating physician doesn't apply, unless the treating physician is, so you know, unless other people have a better approach.
And the other point is what was provided to us by counsel in the administrative record is the notice of award letter. And that says nothing. And what one really has to do in order to determine what was the Social Security Administration looking at and what was MetLife's administrative record comprised of really is something that would be required.
Well, did you do that?
if Holmstrom is contending that there's a correlation.
But is there any reason? This strikes me as a new argument on your part, because I thought you were just sort of waving a magic wand saying, well, everybody says they're different, and so we don't have to pay any attention to the Social Security award. I don't know that there's any reason to believe that the package of evidence Holmstrom presented to the Social Security Administration is any different from the package she presented to you.
Well, it does not have the opinion. The Social Security file does not have the opinion of Dr. Manolakis. Does not have the opinion of
Dr. Manolakis eventually comes very close to saying she is, in fact, long-term disabled. You know, at some point you seem to worry about the timing, and then at other points you don't seem to worry about the timing.
Well, the timing is a factor, because there's 2 years after the coverage ended. So
but
that's
is there
something
any reason to think that Dr. Manolakis, once he read this data, wouldn't have thought that this is how she's been all along? I mean, these are all people, of course, who've never seen her.
Right. I mean, it's very complex, because in deciding how much weight an administrator gives to a piece of evidence, there's evidence for and against. Dr. Van, who provided these range of motion measurements relating to the forearm, provided them 2 years late after we had consistently requested them during the contemporaneous period in which coverage was in place. But Dr. Van also provided information and opinions that Ms. Holmstrom can't actually in his APS. He said that she can't sit for more than 1 hour, stand for more than 15 minutes, or walk for more than 15 minutes. And there was no evidence to support that. So I think there's fundamental questions.
What kind of evidence would you be looking for? I mean, I certainly can understand not worrying about a treating physician, but the fact for a pain case that you think for something that by definition can't be tracked down to, you know, the broken leg or something. It seems very difficult to imagine how you can come to a rational record without at least one person examining her.
Well, I think that...
I'm just having trouble visualizing. What does the evidence look like that says, well, she really can sit for 2 hours?
What was needed was a valid FCE. MetLife did an FCE in this case in 2000. It was the first FCE. That FCE contained range of motion measurements, strength tests. It contained detailed descriptions of the nature of the pain that was preventing certain activity. It contained reflex examinations. It contained sensory tests. So there was an understanding when there was difficulty, for example, keyboarding. What was the nature and description of the pain? But the two FCEs that were submitted by Ms. Holmstrom did not contain that data. It did not contain that level of detail. In fact, the 2007 FCE contained this statement. Mrs. Holmstrom stood for 6 minutes on both legs before asking for a seat. The conclusion was, she can't sit.
Well, I'm looking actually at the 2007 FCE, and then on the next page it goes on. I mean, it's just lots of different things. Paragraph 1, how standing on each leg. Paragraph 2, walking. Paragraph 3, sitting. Paragraph 4, maximum lifting capacity of 20.0 pounds on left hand, 10.0 pounds on right hand. Lower to hip carrying capacity of 10.0 pounds. I mean, it goes on and on with
yes.
The very kind of data that you're talking about.
No, with lists of conclusions.
Well,
not with data.
What? How? So.
What was the nature of the pain that prevented her from sitting for 20 minutes? Was it hip pain? Was it arm pain? Where is the data that helps to correlate this inability supposedly to sit for 20 minutes with the conclusion that she can't sit for 20 minutes? And that kind of detail was in MetLife's FCE. Completely lacking from this 2007 FCE. These are just ipsy-dixit conclusions. They don't withstand peer review.
It's hard for me to imagine that if this had added the sentence, because she was experiencing so much pain in her arm, she had to get up and move around, that you would have accepted it. I maybe would have, but...
Well, MetLife did accept an FCE that it did. that did contain these detailed descriptions of the nature of the pain. The problem is, what is the nature of the pain that prevents her from sitting for 20 minutes? Because ultimately, this is a condition that when the examining physicians, Dr. Klein, the neurologist, for example, the only thing he found was tenderness around the right elbow.
But that's so, totally consistent with the definitions of this complex reflex sympathetic.
But it's totally inconsistent with Mrs. Holmstrom sat for 20 minutes, therefore Mrs. Holmstrom cannot sit. That's totally inconsistent with that FCE finding.
You think that the person who did the FCE should be disbarred from doing such things?
No, I think an FCE, if the court is going to call an FCE an objective test, as it did in Williams, there needs to be the indicia of an objective examination.
Did you spell out those standards of what you expected in your communications to Mrs. Holmstrom and her lawyer?
It was very clear that in those letters that we were seeking objective tests. Mm-hmm. We were seeking, for example, for the...
Did you spell out the requirements that you're telling us today were lacking? Were they that specific?
We did ask for measurements, yes.
Okay.
That's clear throughout the records.
Did you indicate measurements of particular things? You know, where was the pain? You know, which hip? Here's the kind of test we think needs to be done.
No, we didn't give them the standards for doing an FCE. They, of course, did have our FCE, our 10-page FCE, not the one-page FCE that they provided.
Well, this isn't one page, but anyway.
Well, the 2005 one is. The one that showed, that concluded that Ms. Holmstrom has zero mobility in her back and that her back is completely rigid. That's not objective.
Is it MetLife's position that she's malingering?
It's hard to say at this point. What we have are EMG studies.
She's been on heavy-duty painkillers for about 10 years, right?
She's been on methadone. Clearly, at the beginning, while we were paying her, she was having some narcotic problems, and she was double-dipping. She was seeing different doctors.
That all kind of washed out, though, because you paid her for years
after that. With the methadone.
Right.
She was started on methadone, and that problem cleared out. Mm-hmm. So there was, early on, there was drug-seeking behavior. And that does address, in part of your question.
So your own, it's Dr. Menalakis, right, who says these are very heavy doses of methadone, 250 milligrams three times a day is really a whopping, he said, dose.
Right. Yeah. And the federal government says that methadone does not cause cognitive deficits.
Generally.
Generally. And that's why we requested neurocognitive testing, and this, Your Honor, we actually were very specific with.
But one of the other doctors did say that it was clouding her thinking and perceptions.
I think that was Dr. Vant.
Who knew her best?
Who knew her best, but also was her advocate.
Well, we don't know. I mean,
Dr. Vant noted in his medical records, first of all, he noted when she tried Lyrica that she was sedated. But when you look at the contemporaneous medical records, he didn't note in those exam records that she was feeling sedated from methadone. And I would have think if he would have recorded it for Lyrica and took her off it, he would have recorded it for methadone. But he didn't.
Or do we make anything of relatively frequent moves by this woman?
I don't make anything of that, Your Honor.
And she ended up in Canada?
She's in Canada.
She's been in Canada for a long time, though, right?
Yes, I believe she moved, sometime in 2004. Mr. Dabowski might be more accurate with regard to that, but it was about that time period. That's correct.
So, isn't health care more readily available in Canada for folks who have chronic conditions?
It currently is. Yes, we certainly don't have that in our country at this point. And Canada, I think, is she has free health care. Yet, she didn't seek any specialty treatment. She stayed with Dr. Vant, who was a family physician.
Of course, under the Canadian system, maybe specialty treatment is harder to access.
Well, I don't know. If someone has a disabling condition that requires specialty treatment, I would hate to think Canada would deny that.
I have no idea.
But we specifically requested getting back neurocognitive testing and psychological assessment because the record reflects MetLife was concerned about a psychological and emotional element that was impacting the perception of pain. That's where MetLife was...
Let me ask you a question. You know, this comes up with the fibromyalgia cases. It comes up with cases like this. There certainly are some people who experience very high levels of pain that no one can figure out where it's coming from. And the pain perception is so high that there are functional limitations. Is it MetLife's position that those people are not entitled to disability benefits?
No, it's MetLife's position that if someone is experiencing pain from an unknown source, the perception of pain might be real. But in terms of disability administration, one must come up with reliable measurements and data as to what...
Is that consistent with our cases? See, I'm worried that you're actually saying that if we can't pin the pain down to some objective measurement or data, then it can't be disabling. And that doesn't seem consistent to me.
Well, in order to determine whether someone can... I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. Go, please.
In order to determine whether or not someone can perform their job, one needs to know whether the pain interferes with functionality. So of necessity, one needs to correlate a medical condition or a symptom, such as pain, to functional limitations. That's the only way that one can determine if one is unable to perform the duties of their occupation or not.
But then we get back to Judge Hamilton's question. You know, when she says, I'm in such pain, you know, I can't sit for more than 20 minutes, and she just won't do it, you know, is she A, malingering, or B, is she really subjectively experiencing so much pain that she can't do it? How do you decide?
You decide, certainly one way is valid FCEs that say something more than ipse dixit conclusions of she stood for a few minutes before asking for a seat, and have that be the end. That's basically taking an administrator's discretion and giving it to the claimant so that when the claimant says their level of pain is so high that they can't work, that there's nothing that the administrator can do,
but they have the
discretion to award themselves benefits.
Sure, I understand your concern, but the FCE tester isn't her treating physician. These are both independent organizations, right, who did these tests. And so why do they have... you know, a dog in the hunt. You know, why do they care how long she can stand or sit?
Well, the second one was actually retained by counsel.
But an independent company, just like you retained Dr. Manolakis.
Right.
So we're not going to say just because you retain somebody, you don't listen to them. That would be very counterproductive to your position.
Thank you. I agree with that, too. And that's, you know, I would extend that to Glenn as well. But nonetheless, I know my time is up. If I may make, you know, one more point, please look at the three FCEs that are here. The one done by MetLife in 2000, the one done in 2005, by Kelly Leslie, and the one done in 2007 by Ms. Fassigan. The detail contained in the MetLife FCE have the indicia of reliability because it has detailed descriptions so that there's an understanding of why this person's pain is prohibiting her from working. And that explanation and level of detail is lacking in these ipse dixit conclusions that are contained in the other FCEs. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. How much time?
These are not ipse dixit conclusions. These are measured findings and clinical findings made by physicians, such as Dr. Vant, Dr. Klein, and made by physiotherapists such as Ms. Fassigan. There was no specification made to Ms. Holmstrom, we need you to have an FCE that follows the X protocol. They said, get an FCE. She got an FCE. But I think that the most telling point in all of this is the fact that for 5 years MetLife accepted Ms. Holmstrom's allegations, her treating doctor's opinions, and all of that was good enough not only to initially approve the benefits in 2000, but to reapprove the benefits in 2002 under the any occupation standard, to reapprove the benefits again in 2003, to reapprove the benefits again in 2004. This file is replete with objective data that fully corroborates Ms. Holmstrom's complaints as well as corroborative witness statements. MetLife asked for descriptions of activities of daily living. They were provided. It was never good enough. Ms. Holmstrom
Those
could never hit the target.
Those are not discussed in the award, are they? Your evidence of daily living, the husband and the other people?
The lower court just basically brushed it aside because and accepted MetLife's conclusions that the husband and the son and the sister-in-law didn't measure what they saw, which, of course, is absurd.
Mr. Dabowski, in a lot of cases involving these subjective kinds of complaints of pain, which obviously pose all kinds of problems for the disability companies, for the courts, for the claimants, I often wind up seeing surveillance evidence. Was that done here?
Absolutely not.
It might have been done but didn't show up in the record?
Could have been done. If MetLife disbelieved Ms. Holmstrom, what better way to find out what her daily activities were than to send somebody to follow her around? I assume that's legal in Canada just as it is here. The conclusion that this court has to reach is that the decision made by MetLife to terminate Ms. Holmstrom's benefits after 5 years was arbitrary and capricious. And because the benefits were not only approved under the any occupation standard, but reapproved two more times before the benefits were terminated under the standards of Hackett versus Xerox, this court should reinstate Ms. Holmstrom's benefits with interest and attorney's fees. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.